number of years ago, two cardiologists by the name of Rosenman and Friedman wrote a best-selling book entitled Type A Behavior and Your Heart. In their practice as cardiologists, they noted that there were some similarities or a profile of behaviors that seemed to characterize patients that they were seeing. And they formulated a simple and yet very workable concept characterizing what they call type A and type B behavior. Type A behavior people are basically afflicted with two primary maladies, two behavioral patterns that work against them. The first of these is that they suffer from hurry sickness. It's important for them to be someplace else, and they can hardly wait to get from one event to the other. As part of their hurry sickness, they exhibited what Friedman and Rosenman referred to as polyphasic living. That is, they were experiencing life with more than one event at a time. You know, the kind of person who sits at the breakfast table, reads the morning news, carries on a conversation with the kids, and shaves. The kind of person who drives to work and reads while driving. This is a person who is so time-conscious and so desperate to get something done that he can't wait. The kind of person, for example, who finishes sentences for you. The kind of person who sits on the edge of the chair. The kind of person who is extremely impatient. The inability, the unwillingness to take time in relationships, and so on. One fast food chain that has very thoroughly researched its relationship with its market has found that they have less than 40 seconds to serve the customer before the customer's behavior will turn to impatience. Think about your own experience. You walk into one of these places, you get in a line, it seems to be the shorter line. Naturally, that's the line that's going to take longer. Initially, you don't mind waiting. 10 seconds go by, it's no big deal. 20 seconds go by, I can sure understand that. I'll be up soon. 30 seconds, we begin to start wondering, did I make the right choice of line? And when we hit the 40-second mark, we're starting to get impatient with the restaurant for not putting on enough staff, or with the fellow in front of us who's taking too long with his order. A second characteristic that was found to be present in people that Friedman and Rosenman referred to as type A's is that they were suffering from free-floating hostility. We've heard of free-floating anxiety when we're worried about something, can't really put our finger on it. Free-floating hostility is where a person is angry, but he's not angry at any one particular situation or person. They're just kind of angry at everything. They're angry at life. This anger boils over. It's not really focused on any one person or situation, so there's no rational or reasonable understanding of this emotion. The new employee starts work, goes into the boss's office, gets chewed out. Employee comes out looking dismayed and says to one of the older workers, "What did I do?" And the old pro, who's been around the office a while, says, "Ah, it's not you. He's that way with everybody." This is the kind of person who sometimes in a meeting is seen drumming their pencil on the table. And the drumming behavior is literally a physical hitting kind of behavior. Sometimes they speak with a clenched fist, sometimes with clenched teeth. Sometimes they are heavy gum chewers, the biting, chewing kind of behavior. And this is a person who is obviously under a lot of tension and under a lot of pressure. The interesting thing, said Friedman and Rosenman, is that most of it is not caused by their situation. It's caused by their own perception of the world. They're super competitive, super aggressive kinds of individuals. Maybe 10% of the people around us are like that. They're pure type A's. At the other end of the scale are the 10% who are type B's. What are type B's like? Type B's are people who tend to be as achievement-oriented. They, too, want to get things done. But they don't seem to be in a horse race. They just seem to be consistent in applying themselves and getting the work done. But they're not in any panic to get the work done. They know that there's always enough time to do what really counts in life, and they keep pressing and pushing until they get the job accomplished. They tend to avoid polyphasic living. They tend to build more complete social relationships. They tend to take time to enjoy life. They tend to be people, in fact, who rise to the top of corporate hierarchies. Contrary to the popular myth, the hard, aggressive, chew people out, get it done at all costs, burn your bridges behind you kind of person may be effective as a first-line supervisor, but does not tend to emerge as the president of Fortune 500 companies. Type Bs, who tend to wear well with people, who tend to be more cooperative rather than independent in their relationships, will tend to be people who will emerge at the top where teamwork and coordination is more critical, more important. And, said Friedman and Rosenman, the other 80% of the people are somewhere in between, showing a little type A behavior and some type B behavior, kind of a mix of the two. The key point from their research was that most of the people they were seeing as cardiologists tended to be type A or had a marked tendency toward a predominance of type A behavior. These people tended to have far more heart attacks as a percentage of the total heart attack population, and they tended to receive a second heart attack or a third heart attack. They also were more likely to have a fatal heart attack. In fact, they set themselves up for failure and for health problems and for death. Friedman and Rosenman offered a number of helpful remedies that we might refer to as positive prescriptions for personal living. One of the things that they noted is that relaxation is a necessity. Many people, when they go on vacation, call the office repeatedly. They take a briefcase full of work with them when they go. The fellow who works in the plant goes home on vacation and instead of going fishing, spends the next 2 weeks doing nothing but home repairs. They're continually obsessed with getting it done, getting it done, getting it done. They don't seem to have any definition of success outside of work itself. Sometimes it's the mother who leaves the baby with the babysitter and is unable to relax, unable to leave it, and in the movie jumps up 3 times to call the babysitter to see how things are going. And we understand now from stress research that it is important that we take relaxation and that we take breaks and that we view these things not as a luxury, nothing that we should feel guilty about, not that we're goofing off, but that in fact these are absolutely necessary insulating periods of time to help us recharge, help us get a new perspective on the world around us, and help us kind of mellow out from the disturbances that we have been experiencing somewhere else. Another prescription for personal living is to systematically eliminate as many unnecessary events, activities, and people as you can from your life. Every event, activity, and person that you encounter carries a certain stress load with them. When you consider the things that you're doing in your life, do you find that it's possible that you have overloaded? Some of you are such good people that you're spending every spare moment doing things to help others. You're running the United Way drive, you're active in your church, you're taking responsibility for organizing the class reunion. You're doing all of these wonderful things, and you don't seem to ever find any time for you. You don't seem to ever find any outlet that favors you. You're doing continually for others. Sometimes wives and mothers will report that this seems to be the way their life goes. They're continually depended upon by a husband and by children, and they find themselves extended in so many directions, giving to so many people, that there never is any time for themselves. An alert husband will understand that they have to take on some of these chores and some of these household duties and split some of these responsibilities to avoid putting his wife in a very bad situation. Can you eliminate some events, activities, and people from your life? But Clay, they need me down at the synagogue to teach Old Testament. Well, maybe somebody else ought to have that growth experience this year. Well, gee, Clay, the house isn't clean to Betty Bandbox standards. Well, how about if we just settle for picking up the clutter daily and do the major house cleaning once a year rather than every week? Maybe there are some other things that are worth doing because you're much more important than the condition of your house. They're not going to write on your tombstone, "Gee, she had a clean bathroom." It's important to put things into perspective. Get out of doing some things. A third suggestion. Is there anything you can do to re-engineer or redesign The Way Your Life Goes. Think of a stressor in your life that is continually repeating. Maybe it's the traffic. Maybe it's shopping. Is there some other time that you could do this task? Is there some other way in which you could do this task? Could you get somebody else to do this task for you? In other words, can you redesign or build it in a different way so that it is not as stressful as it would otherwise be? I know a number of people that have to commute a long way, and one of the things that they do is engineer an agreement with their boss that says, I'll come to the office 2 hours earlier, but I'd like to be able to leave 2 hours earlier also. I avoid the rush hour traffic on both sides that way. In some work environments, this has led to the evolution of what we now call flex time, allowing people to come and go at times that are advantageous to them, and yet with no loss of productive energy and output and contribution to the organization. Even though my wife loves to go shopping, one thing that does irritate her continually is doing the food shopping. She used to go at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The stores would be jammed and the aisles would be crowded and the clerks would be tired and the sale merchandise would be gone. And liking this concept of re-engineering, she simply decided, hey, I'm going to go Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock. The weekend sales merchandise is piled to the ceiling. Clerks are rested. I feel more energetic. Nobody's in the store yet. Makes it a lot shorter, simpler, and easier task. The same work is being done. The same life event is being experienced, but being experienced in a totally different way because it's been redesigned. The best kind of task to start that idea with is the repetitive task, something that is particularly irritating and gives the motivation to try this technique. See if you can find some solutions that will work for you in that area, and then extrapolate and multiply that effort by trying to re-engineer a bunch of other things. Recently, I was rushing to O'Hare Airport. I used to be the kind of person that looked like O.J. Simpson in the ads, and I would fly through the airport. My idea was to slide into my parking slot, run through the terminal, get onto the plane just as they were slamming the door behind me, because, you see, I read Chapter 1 in a time management book that said, never waste time. Then I read Chapter 2. Chapter 2 said, use waiting time productively. And so what I do now is to leave deliberately early. And I no longer have to worry, am I going to make it to the airport on time? As I used to, because now I know I have plenty of time. If there's a road obstruction, if there's a barrier, if there's an accident, I know I still have enough time to make it. And when I get to the gate and have a little bit of time remaining, I can sit there and read, using that waiting time productively. I haven't wasted time, you see. It's just that I've re-engineered my life to avoid the stress. Recently, on a trip out of town driving through an exact change toll lane, I noticed in the neighboring lane a fellow in a Mercedes, and he was having a conversation. I don't know who he was having a conversation with because there was no one else in the car with him, but he was red-faced and he was beating upon the steering wheel and was saying something in a very loud voice. He was saying, I don't have any change. In such a circumstance, this person might have re-engineered his life by carrying loose change in the car. Why experience stress that you can simply build out of the system? Another prescription for personal living, perhaps one of the most powerful I've ever encountered, is to ask yourself a question at the moment you feel the blood pressure starting to rise. Will it make a difference in 5 years? What kind of perspective would time give to this current problem you're suffering from? One of the things that we know about stress is that in order for a situation to be stressful, we must perceive it as a threatening situation. If we do not see it that way, it will not elicit the fear response and this terrific mobilization. Have you encountered this situation? You walk out of a store, you count the change in your hand, you look at it, you realize the sales clerk has slighted you 9 cents, and a whole bunch of things go through your mind. This kid has cheated you deliberately. This kid is ripping you off. It's probably passive-aggressive behavior on his part. This kid has probably got 1,000 people going through that lane every day, and he's shortchanging each one of them 9 cents, and he's got a Swiss bank account, and all of this stuff is going through your head, and you're going to have his job, and you're going to lay it on the line with a manager, and you're going to take this thing to court, and you have a heart attack and die in the parking lot. Will this make a difference in 5 years? The thing about asking that question is that it applies the test of time to current events. At the moment, everything is important. At that precise instant that you encounter the situation, it has the power of immediacy, and that makes an unbelievable difference in your mind. Yet when you have the ability to be able to stand back and say, you know, in 5 years I won't even remember this thing. In 5 years I won't even remember it next week. Just taking this perspective tends to shrink things into their relative degree of importance. Now, supposing one night you're sitting in your living room and a heavy knock comes on the door. You open the door only to look up into a 7-foot-tall, 350-pound guy with a Hell's Angel jacket. He's got a big beer belly on him, a tattoo across his forehead that says, "Born to Kill," and he says to you, "Is your daughter Cynthia home?" Is that going to make a difference in 5 years? You bet your bird. Let her rip. Let those juices go. Asking yourself the question will help you calibrate. Have I got a big problem here, or have I got a little problem? Because, folks, in life, the magic words are, don't sweat the small stuff. If you're going to get juiced up over something, make sure it's at least worthwhile. Another suggestion for personal living is to borrow a major concept from the principles of time management, and that is to do one thing at a time. One of the characteristic behaviors of type A people is that they're doing many things at the same time, and they tend to do none of them well, and they tend to get confused. In a carefully controlled study, it was found that groups of managers were able to actually get more things done and to do them better when they did them sequentially, one item after the other, as opposed to those managers who did them concurrently, trying to do all kinds of things all at the same time. Do one thing at a time. Complete that task, and then do the next item. Because what that kind of behavior does is it focuses all of your efforts on only one task. You have to deal with the problem elements and details of only one problem. That's not asking your mind to encompass and deal with too much at once. But when you give it 16 problems, and you're worrying about 20 other problems, and you're trying to carry all of that load all at one time, you're carrying one terrific mental strain that is just going to bust all the circuits. Do one thing at a time, and then do the next item. That is simple-minded genius. In a remarkable interview, Albert Einstein was once asked this question. "Dr. Einstein, what do you think about when you're tying your shoes?" Because the interviewer just knew that this great genius had to be conceptualizing whole new pictures of the universe and coming up with complex redefinitions and mathematical formulae. And listening to the question, Einstein responded, "Well, mostly, young man, when I am tying my shoe, I think about the bow." My simple recommendation is to be a simple-minded genius and do one thing at a time. Don't overload the circuits. Another key and important prescription in terms of our personal living is to pay attention to people. My stockbroker called me. This is a fellow I have a new relationship with. And we've not really established what we might call a firm friendship. And yet he called me and started unloading because he had just received news that a friend of his for many years, who is his same age, 52, had died while lying on the couch in his living room over the weekend. He was verbalizing his anxiety about that because this man was the first of his contemporaries to die. And the rush of thoughts about our own mortality came in, and he was bothered by this, saying, I'm rushing around like crazy, making a lot of money. And for the first time in my life last night, it struck me. Maybe none of this counts. What is it that does count in this life? Most people come to a basic conclusion sooner, hopefully, not later, that the things that really count are the people and the relationships that we have. One recent writer expressed it this way: when the news comes that the rockets are on their way, the last 5 minutes of humanity will find all of us jammed into telephone booths trying to get through. Think about those people in your life that mean something. The one, the two, the three. There may not be a whole lot more than that. And what kind of attention are you paying to these people? Some time ago, when my wife held a position as a director of nursing at a mental retardation facility for youngsters, I, with my former pure type A behavior, drove up to pick her up from the hospital, only to find that she was not instantly available and waiting for me at the door. And because I was a type A person at that time, suffered drastically from hurry sickness, I would not want to waste time getting out of the car, so I wanted to send her a signal. Even though I was in a hospital zone where quiet is the rule, I blew the horn. And when this behavior, after 10 seconds of patient waiting, did not cause any immediate response, I blew the horn again, this time hitting the horn button harder, because we all know if you hit it harder, it makes it blow louder. Anyway, she didn't respond to the second horn blast either, so I left the car in park, motor running, not wanting to waste time restarting the car, letting it sit in a no-parking zone, and walked impatiently into the office area. The door to her office was shut, a typical signal that says, "Wait outside, please, I'm busy now." Did this mean anything to me? No, it did not mean anything to me, so I opened the door, interrupting a meeting that she is having with her nurse managers. Now picture the scene, folks. This is an executive. This is a person who has half of the people and half of the total organization budget as her responsibility. Who am I? I'm a nobody in this organization. I'm not an employee. I am not any way associated. But I am her husband. And in my type A sexist behavior, I was imposing my needs upon the reality of her situation. So I burst through the door and in my trombone manner say, "Ann." Have you ever noticed when you're impatient, you never say, "Ann, Bill"? We always say, "Ann, Bill." And knowing how to handle me, Ann responds, "Clay, I will be done when I am finished." Now, you can't beat the logic of that, folks. And knowing that while I don't have, as obviously illustrated here, the sensitivity given to a golf ball, nonetheless, knowing how to handle me, she said, "Look, I'm short an aide today. Little Billy down the hall there that you can see has not yet had his applesauce to finish his dinner, and I want you to go down and feed him." Being a former surgical orderly, I do have some talents. So I went down the hall, grabbing a dish of applesauce off the cart, looking at this kid with a look of vengeance. The only thing that was keeping me from getting home was this kid and his applesauce. So I was completely focused on this task. I went up to him, and I started jamming this applesauce in his mouth with a spoon, and the applesauce was running down his cheeks. I don't know if you've ever had the experience and privilege of knowing someone who is retarded. There seems to be some compensatory behaviors, things in their behavior that you do not see in normal people, that gives them a particular charm and a particular set of skills for dealing with interpersonal situations. One of the things that these people will do is they smile a lot if you give them any attention, and they will talk with you, and they will sometimes break spontaneously into singing. So there I was, and I was paying attention, not in a very positive way, I am sure, to Billy, feeding him his applesauce. And Billy is gurgling and talking through his applesauce, smiling at me, and I'm shoving this stuff down his throat as fast as I could. Billy is singing in his life, and I am the guy on my way to an early grave. Pay attention to the people around you, because they are the best part. All that money you're making is for them, right? Well, maybe they'd like to have some of your time. In the long run, nobody cares about all of the other things you're doing to increase your social status. Nobody will remember what clubs you were vice president of. What is it that you've done for the people in your life? That's where the real action and the real satisfaction is. One last suggestion for personal living. Remember that life remains unfinished. It does not really matter if you clean out every single paper in your in-basket the night before you go home. That isn't going to make you a successful employee. It doesn't really matter that every little speck of dust has not been removed from the house. What really counts is to get the important tasks accomplished today, those that will bring you satisfaction and good results. There's always time for tomorrow. Don't live life as a 100-yard dash runner who has to put out total 100% energy each and every moment. Instead, live life like a long-distance marathoner and go for the distance. You can cross the goal line in the same fashion. Remember, folks, death is nature's way of telling you, slow down. In Gail Sheehy's excellent book, Passages, is contained this very cogent thought. To accept what is enough, good enough, rich enough, successful enough, thin enough, social enough. When you have self-esteem, you are enough. If you don't grow, you're not living, just existing. And if you don't change, you don't grow. Growth means a temporary surrender of security, leaving the familiar for the uncertain. Maturity may mean giving up safe but unrewarding work, giving up values no longer believed in, giving up familiar life patterns, giving up relations that have lost meaning. Taking a different step is what people fear most, but the real fear should be the opposite. In a variety of studies, it's been determined that certain managers have mental strength and resilience, while others do not. Certain managers display a type of mental toughness that keeps them going during difficult periods and allows them to interact effectively with others around them and get work done. This finding is important for a variety of reasons. First, the manager's own individual happiness depends on living life in a way that will allow him to ride through the rough spots. And secondly, because the manager is such a key person in supervising and directing the lives of many other people, if this person is unhappy or malfunctioning, there's going to be a terrible price paid by the subordinates of this individual. The profile that emerges from studies done at the Menninger Clinic in Kansas and elsewhere is that managers that are possessed with mental strength and resiliency during periods of stress have five major characteristics. You might want to use this list as a profile and ask yourself, how well do I measure up in each of these five areas? First, managers with mental strength and stress resistance capability are those that have a wide variety of sources of gratification. A gratification source is any event or situation or activity that gives happiness, joy, satisfaction to the manager. Typically, these are men and women who do not put all the eggs of their personal satisfaction into their work life. That is, they're not workaholics who are devoted exclusively to finding their self-satisfaction in their job. Rather, these are people who, while they find a lot of enjoyment in their career achievements, are also people who are active socially, who enjoy their family, who have hobbies and activities. In short, they have put the satisfaction eggs in a variety of baskets rather than putting all of their focus in life into the job alone. Managers that do not have a lot of strength are typically unidimensional. They have few dimensions to their life. And when one life segment goes sour, they have no other supporting areas that they can turn to. We sometimes see this in a marriage situation where the marriage may have been the only source of gratification, happiness, and satisfaction. when the marriage goes sour, that particular person in the marriage who was so oriented is really bereft of any other sources. The person with a wide variety of sources of gratification can, when something goes bad, for example, job termination, find satisfaction in reinforcing messages coming from family, from friends, from social contacts, from hobbies, from writing or reading interests, and so on, that confirm back to him, you're okay, you're fine, you're able to function, see how capable you are in each of these other areas of life. And that's a very important set of messages to have when there is stress in one segment of life. A second characteristic of these men and women in management who are very strong in their ability to deal with problems is that they tend to be flexible under stress. They tend to view problem solving through a variety of lenses. Some people typically are bulldozers. They believe in going through the problem. And sometimes when you can't go through the problem, these individuals are at a loss. So the people who become skilled in finding a variety of ways of dealing with things and tend to be individuals who can go around the problem, can go under the problem, can go over the problem, might even redefine the problem as not a problem. And this flexibility, this bounce back ability, gives them the characteristic of not defining defeat as anything but a temporary phenomenon. There's a well-known story of the farm boy who suffered the loss of his childhood sweetheart through her early death, and subsequently married a person who was very unhealthy mentally. He had to live in a family relationship that was very unhappy. He went into a general store business that failed, and it took him many years to pay off that debt. He later went on to a practice of law and was unsuccessful in the selection of his law firm partner and had to carry that individual for many years. He tried to run for the House of Representatives and was unsuccessful in that attempt. Later went on to run for the United States Senate, this time against an individual who was one of the most popular and most powerful senators of his time, and was totally buried in a landslide of votes for his opponent. He was later elected president of the United States. Abraham Lincoln was the archetype of this flexibility under stress. He suffered a series of life-crushing blows, of situations that would leave a lot of people whimpering by the side of the road. Understanding that failure is not failure of the self, it's simply that circumstances have not come together the way you would like them to. He had the ability to keep coming back. When I was a young boy, my mother bought for me an inflatable Bozo doll that stood about 4 feet tall, had a weighted sand bottom, and when you hit Bozo in the nose, he would go down and then would come back because of the weight of the bottom. That's really the kind of image that I have in my mind of the manager who is flexible under stress. You're not successful landing every punch. You don't win every fight. The question is, do you keep coming back? Rocky Graziano was noted for often being knocked down in the course of a fight. And as middleweight champion of the world, famous for the quotation when being criticized once for being knocked down so often, he said, "It doesn't matter how many times they knock you down. What counts is how many times you get up." The reason that he was a champion, the reason that any individual is a winner in a leadership spot or just in human living, is this ability to be flexible and to come back under stress and to look for other ways of approaching it. If it didn't work this time, let's try another method. We'll find the correct combination eventually. The third major characteristic that came out of the Menninger studies was that managers who are successful in the sense of having mental resiliency are those that recognize the fact that there is, in all of us, a balance sheet of liabilities and assets. They look at themselves in the mirror and say, "Geez, I'm pretty terrific and wonderful and great. I do a lot of good stuff, and I'm really proud of myself. But over on this side, I'm not so great. Not real swift. Kind of poor in that behavior. I don't seem to be able to quite cut the mustard there." They see themselves from a pretty realistic viewpoint as having both limitations and assets. And they don't get all tied up or wound up over the fact that there are some failings in their own behavior. They recognize what they are. They recognize what they are not. And they basically have learned to accept that package however it has come. And because of the fact that they accept themselves, they do not beat themselves to death over the things that they cannot do. Some people are continually guilt-ridden and worry constantly about the things they cannot do, as illustrated in a classic poem entitled The Centipede. You know what a centipede is, a little insect with 20 pairs of legs and they all move in wave-like fashion. The poem reads, "A centipede was happy, quite, until a frog in fun said, 'Pray, which leg comes after which?' This raised her mind to such a pitch, she lay distracted in the ditch, considering how to run." One of the things that we see in managers with mental strength is that they do not lie distracted in the ditch. They know how to run, and they accept themselves for whatever they are. Because they are able to self-accept, they are then able to do what the fourth characteristic calls for, and that is to treat others as individuals. If I have strengths and weaknesses, and I can recognize that you do too, it doesn't bother me that you're not a perfect person. And I'm going to deal with you not as a class of individuals. I'm not going to deal with you based on stereotypes. I'm going to deal with you as an individual and be very accepting of what and who you are personally. That's just the way life is. I'm not going to try and change the world to fit my concept of it. I'm certainly not going to try to change you to be something other than what you are. If we can like each other and work together and be with each other, great. Let's do it. Having that ability, that people focus, allows them to accept others. The key point in the Menninger study was, the managers who can't accept others are usually those at war with themselves. They cannot accept themselves first. And sometimes supervisors who are highly critical of subordinates or of bosses or of other departments tend to be people who really have got a lot of unanswered questions regarding themselves. Let's live at peace with each other. The last characteristic is that these are people who are very active and productive. These are not lethargic people. These are not unenergetic people. These are people who basically tackle the task, who handle the problem of the day, who deal with it. And because they have that orientation, that in fact true management orientation to their job, they also carry that over into their personal life. If there's a problem in the personal life, let's work on it. If there's a difficulty in a relationship, let's deal with it. Let's confront it. Let's get on with it. Let's not sit here and stare at each other. Let's not contemplate our navels. Let's not go off in a corner and die. Let's be active. Let's be productive. Let's solve this like we would solve any other in a string of problems. In short, it's almost as though they make a philosophical stance between themselves and the world that says, hey, if times are tough, so what? I'm here. I'm in charge. And I'm going to deal with this thing. They have had so much success in the past that they feel they are in charge, that they are riding on the back of this situation, and that situations are not riding on their back. It's a key perceptual difference of how they encounter stressors that helps them to be mentally strong.